Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us. I'm very privileged this morning to be joined by Jorge Martí. He's the Secretariat of Hands Up Venezuela. Welcome to our show, Jorge.
It's a pleasure to be with you again.
Today we are focusing on one of our heroes, our revolutionary heroes, Che Guevara. Can you tell us about Che Guevara? Who was this person, this icon?
Yes, Che Guevara is an immediately recognizable figure. He's been in many posters and t-shirts, but not many people know about his life, his revolutionary struggle, and his ideas. He was born in Argentina into a middle-class family, but then became a revolutionary fighter. He participated in the revolutionary struggle in Cuba from 1956 to 1959. And after the victory of the Cuban Revolution, he was part of the government that was put in place. He, in different capacities, he was a minister of industry, he was president of the Cuban National Bank, and he participated in all of the debates that the Cuban Revolution had open. Debates about revolutionary strategy, debates about how to develop the economy, debates about the question of bureaucracy and bureaucratization in the revolution, debates about the need for internationalism. And not only he participated in these debates, but then he took from 1965 the decision to go and fight in other countries. He was an internationalist to the core. He fought in Congo against imperialism, and then he went in 1967, he went to Bolivia, where after an unsuccessful attempt to start a guerrilla struggle, he was captured and then killed by the Bolivian army with the participation of the CIA. So you could say that what defines Che Guevara is the fact that he was a revolutionary fighter, and he finally gave his life for the cause of the emancipation of the oppressed and the exploited in Latin America and around the world.
Well, there have been many uprisings, and we see today, in some ways, some victories. What can we learn from this revolutionary process, from previous struggles, and where are we today?
Yes, I think that 50 years after the death of Che Guevara, the situation that he found when he was traveling throughout the continent, in the experience in the traveling period where he became politicized, is the situation hasn't fundamentally changed. He found a situation where the masses in Latin America were suffering from misery, poverty, underdevelopment, while at the same time the local oligarchy was collaborating with imperialism in the domination of these countries, the extraction of natural resources. That situation hasn't fundamentally changed. So the struggle that Che Guevara carried out at that time was still relevant today. And not only this, he also, for instance, witnessed the military coup against Jacobo Arbenz in Guatemala in 1954. At that time, Arbenz was a democratically elected president who was overthrown because he dared pose the question of agrarian reform. And this touched the interest of the United Fruit Company, a U.S.-based multinational, who then the United States went on to carry out a coup against this democratically elected government. This was an experience that was part of the process by which he became a political revolutionary fighter. And even today, we see the same situation continuing. We saw the coup against the democratically elected president of Venezuela in 2002. We saw the coup against Mel Zelaya in Honduras in 2009. And so the role of imperialism continues to be the same. the attempt to remove democratically elected governments and replace them with governments that complain to the interests of the United States. So I will say the example of Che Guevara is still very relevant, but also one particular point that he made in trying to formulate his ideas about revolutionary struggle, I think it's particularly relevant. He said at one point, he said in I was attending a meeting of finance ministers of Latin America in Uruguay, and he said the Latin American bourgeoisie has ceased to play any progressive role, if it ever played one. And the only revolution that is left pending in our countries is the socialist revolution. The bourgeois has become the last carriage in the train of imperialism. And I think that this is still very, very relevant. There is no way that the bourgeoisie, the ruling class, plays any progressive role in any of the Latin American countries. And this is extensive to all the underdeveloped capitalist countries. The only revolution that is left to be carried out is not the democratic revolution or the anti-imperialist revolution. All of these are part and can only be solved through the socialist revolution, which involves the expropriation of the imperialists, but also the expropriation of the local oligarchies. And this, I think, is also the main lesson of the Cuban revolution. The Cuban revolutionaries, when they came to power, they did not have a plan to move towards socialism. Che Guevara was a socialist already at that time, but the organization he had joined, the M26 of July movement, was not a socialist organization. It was an organization that had a program of democratic anti-imperialist reforms. And finally, these anti-imperialist democratic reforms could only be carried out by moving towards socialism and expropriating the imperialists and the local capitalists.
When we look at Latin America, for many years now, Latin America has been the beacon of hope for many countries. I was in Africa and people rave about the revolution in Venezuela. People look up to the Venezuelan government of Chavez as one that was leading the world in a social transformation that was rising, not just the lives of people, but also the hope of the entire region. What can we learn from the last 3-4 years now since Chavez died and new leadership has taken over?
I mean, first of all, we must start by what the situation is now. The situation now in Venezuela is extremely bad from an economic point of view. The masses are suffering from a terrible economic crisis. There's been a collapse in the economy of about 30% in the last 3 or 4 years. There is now hyperinflation. And we must ask ourselves, why is that, and what has happened to the Bolivarian Revolution? The Bolivarian Revolution is a process by which the masses entered into the scene of history. They took the future into their own hands, and they pushed the whole situation forward. There was a process of workers' control, occupation of land, and all of this was promoted and pushed for also by President Chavez, who himself evolved in his political views. At the beginning, he was an anti-imperialist, a consistent Democrat, progressive figure. But then later on, after 2005, he said, look, these reforms that we want to achieve for the people, free education, free healthcare, housing, and so on, we cannot achieve within the limits of capitalism. We must go towards socialism. And I would say that the main problem was that this was never actually implemented in full, in the sense that while there were very high prices for oil, which is the main export of Venezuela, the government used that money to carry out these social reforms. And these social reforms were very wide-ranging, and they really transformed the lives of millions of people in Venezuela, in healthcare, in education, in providing housing to hundreds of thousands of people who didn't have proper housing before. But the economy was never fully transformed. It remained a capitalist economy. with a few rules and regulations introduced by the government, like foreign exchange controls, price controls, and so on. But it was fundamentally a capitalist economy. So when the price of oil collapsed around 2014, the government found itself in serious difficulties. This was now the government of Nicolás Maduro. And so we cannot say that the economic crisis that Venezuela is living in is the result of socialism or socialist mismanagement, as the capitalist will tell you. It's the opposite. I will say the reason for the crisis, the reason for the suffering of the masses and the collapse in living standards that we are witnessing now, which threatens to destroy all the legacy of the Bolivarian Revolution, is the result of not having implemented socialism. In one of his last speeches, President Chavez said in a speech which is called Turn the Rudder, Golpe de Timón, he said, there are still things that need to be done. First of all, we must transform the economy, which is still a capitalist economy, he said, into a socialist economy. And second, we must do away with the old bourgeois state apparatus and build a communal state. That is a state that is based on the communes, the local communes in the peasant areas, in the working class neighborhoods, and so on. And to be perfectly honest, in the last 3 or 4 years, none of this has been done. On the contrary, the government has continued to try to tinker with the capitalist system by making concessions to the capitalists, lifting the price controls, giving them subsidized access to subsidized dollars so that they can import food and other products and parts for industry. And this has not served to help capitalists invest. There's still an enormous sabotage of the economy. And right now there are only two ways forward, I will say, for Venezuela. One is either you go back to Chavez and take his advice of moving towards a socialist economy that is expropriating the private property of the 200 families that control in a monopoly way the distribution of food, the distribution of food products, and so on. Or you then continue to make concessions, and you will not only not solve the economic crisis, but you will prepare the terrain for the ruling class, for the right wing, to come back to power, which will then prepare the way for policies that will abolish every single one of the conquests of the revolution. They will destroy higher education, which is now free of charge for hundreds of thousands of people. They will destroy the pension system. They will destroy the public housing projects that have been created. They will privatize all the state-owned companies, and they will make working class pay the price for the capitalist crisis, and that will be a disaster. But I will say that a large responsibility lies on the current government and its policies that are not addressing the fundamental problems.
I guess having a bigger imagination of a world without capitalism is certainly one path we have not yet explored, you know, as a society in general. I think it's a lot to ask of one country to do that, knowing the threat of invasion is something that has always been looming. How do you respond to people who say, well, if he did do that, if Maduro did go that route, what will prevent the U.S. from, you know, using this as an excuse to invade the country and undoing all of what has been done?
Yes. Well, I will answer two things. One is not going to socialism up until now, not expropriating the capitalist class, has not prevented imperialist intervention. The imperialists have been intervening in Venezuela ever since the beginning of the Bolivarian Revolution in 1998. They participated and organized and funded the coup in 2002. They've organized and funded and supported all the different waves of opposition terrorism and violence in the streets. They attempted to remove Chavez in 2005 through the recall referendum. They've now implemented sanctions and targeted sanctions and financial sanctions against Venezuela. They haven't ceased their attempts to overthrow the government. So in reality, the policy of saying, no, we're going to moderate the revolution, we don't want to go too far for fear of an intervention by the United States, is not preventing an intervention from the United States, but what it's doing is increasing the level of demoralization or cynicism, skepticism on the part of the masses that have always supported the Bolivarian revolution. But they now can see that there is a government that is talking, for instance, about economic war, but then the next day they turn around and they give dollars from the oil income of the country to the main monopoly group that controls the distribution of food in the private sector, which is Grupo Polar, a group of companies that everybody knows has been involved in the sabotage of the economy. Or, for instance, the peasants in Zulia, in Mérida, in Barinas, in Alto Apure, they have said clearly, look, we are fighting against the Guarimba, against the opposition terrorist attempts to overthrow the government last year. But at the same time, in order to fight effectively against this, we have to fight against those who finance these efforts, who finance these terrorist activities. And we know who they are. And they are the big landowners in our territory. So we think that the only way to actually defend the revolution is by expropriating and taking over this land. Secondly, I would also say that if Venezuela was to move forward in that direction, others will follow. That will serve as an enormous inspiration for other countries in Latin America to move forward in the same direction, in the direction of socialism, and will also greatly strengthen the support for the revolution in Venezuela. And that's the best guarantee against imperialist intervention. The problem is that the continuation of the current policies has not solved any of the economic problems of the masses. And for the masses of working people, there starts to be a very dangerous difference between the speeches of the government that still talks about Bolivarianism and socialism and their own concrete experience of hyperinflation, not being able to afford the food they need to eat over a month, the lack of basic products, the lack of medicine, and the general deterioration of living conditions. And that is very dangerous from the point of view of the support for the revolution.
When we think about the case of Venezuela, Hugo Chavez started many programs that were very inspiring, you know, the building of Mercosur, some of the alliances that were created. How are these alliances sustaining now that the government of Lula has, you know, primarily seemed to move to the right? The neighboring countries seem to have governments that are right-wing, leading. How has this threatened the revolution in Venezuela?
Yes, this is clearly the case. The Bolivarian revolution is surrounded by countries, and the balance of forces in Latin America is now moved to the right. But I would say the following: in Brazil, in Colombia, and in Argentina, we now have right-wing governments. But in reality, you can also say that this is not the end of the story. We have seen huge mobilizations in Argentina against the Macri government, against the programs of the Macri government. There was a very big mobilization in December against the pensions reform. There's going to be new mobilizations in the next months against the reform of the labor laws. There have been also big mobilizations in Argentina. And I think that the point is not so much that the people have moved to the right, but rather than a lot of people who supported the governments that existed before became demoralized because these governments were not carrying out left-wing policies, were not doing enough to move forward. So, I mean, the conclusion is that, not that we have to be more moderate, the conclusion is that at the heart of every government in Latin America, there should be the interests of working people in those countries. And if that means clashing with the ruling class, well, so be it. Because if you shy away from that, then all you're doing is disappointing your own supporters. And as I said before, Now the ruling class is saying throughout Latin America, look at Venezuela. Venezuela is an economic disaster, and that's what revolution means. We have to respond to that by showing in practice that revolution, in fact, doesn't mean economic crisis and economic collapse. That revolution means the opposite, putting the economy at the service of the majority. If that was done, then it will be become again a beacon of hope for the peoples of Latin America as a whole. I mean, even today, despite all the difficulties that Cuba is facing, Cuba still has a healthcare system and an education system which is second to none in the whole of the American continent. It even compares favorably with the United States, where obviously you don't have a system of universal healthcare free at the point of service, and where the education system is extremely expensive and is becoming a luxury for many students who can't afford to incur in massive student debt. So I will say that that's the way forward.
I think that in many ways it's because we have such a limited idea of what a coup is. I think we've been thinking of military coups as invasions, and you know, they are our reality. We've known those in Latin America, but there's also political coups, and we see that in North America, for instance, where people the election of the president really means the election of that one who has the most money to run. And so can we talk a little bit about the significance of the election of Donald Trump in the US and what this signals for Venezuela?
Yes, I will say that in reality, people in Venezuela now understand something that they might not be so clear for people in the United States. Some people say, okay, well, the election of Trump is a big disaster because he will pursue a more imperialist policy. And that is true, but only to a certain extent. We must remember that, for instance, the current wave of sanctions that is being implemented by Trump against Venezuela is based on an executive order that was signed by Obama. Obama is the one who started the policy of sanctions against Venezuela, this current wave of sanctions, when he signed an executive order, a decree, that says that Venezuela presents a threat to the national security of the United States. And then they started with targeted sanctions against Venezuelan officials. Now, Donald Trump has followed this policy and has now stepped it up to include financial sanctions, which makes it more difficult for Venezuela to find finance abroad. But the policy of the U.S. administrations has been more or less the same ever since Chavez was elected in 2002. We had the coup, then we had sanctions, the funding of opposition groups, including groups that are involved in violence, and so on. On the other hand, it is true that the fact that you have a Republican in the White House in the United States means also that this person is much more close or amenable to the pressure of the Republican lobby in Miami, which is made up of Cuban exiles, reactionaries, people like Marco Rubio and others, who have a very belligerent interventionist policy towards Latin America. And in that respect, there is a little bit of a change, in as much as these people now have a much bigger influence on the White House. And Donald Trump has made speeches in Florida where he has mentioned the idea of military intervention in Venezuela. This is not been implemented, but it's quite a serious threat that should be taken very seriously. And of course, Donald Trump has been very vocal in all of these questions. He has also taken back some of the measures that Obama implemented in opening up to Cuba. The opening up, the restoration of relations with Cuba is now frozen, and in some cases it has been reversed. I don't think that this will be a decisive factor. I mean, Donald Trump is also a businessman, a capitalist, and there is a big section of the capitalists in the United States who want to be part of the opportunities for business that are opening up in Cuba. And I think that that, in the end, will prevail. So they will still try to overthrow the Cuban government, but they will do it through business. through the penetration of capitalist businesses in the island, they hope to achieve their aims. But in relation to Venezuela, it's true that there has been an increase in belligerence. But we must not forget that, in fact, the Obama administration is the one that started the current policy of sanctions.
You know, I think that sometimes the fear of doing something is greater than actually going through it. And like you said, moving away from a capitalist system, it's very frightening when we have been told and thought to naturalize the process of capitalism. But there's nothing natural about capitalism. There's, you know, in fact, it's being sustained through multiple crises, through multiple, devastating effects of it. So what inspires you? Because sometimes I think that in the midst of our worst moments is exactly when we get our inspiration. It's exactly when we get the courage to do something that is, you know, that perhaps was not even conceivable in the past.
Yes, well, I would say that the situation of capitalism today is so scandalous that in reality there's no other possible conclusion to be drawn that this system is rotten to the core. Now, as we speak, the rich capitalist businessmen and politicians of the world are meeting in Davos in a forum in Switzerland, where they discuss the situation of world capitalism and how to go forward. At the same time of this meeting is taking place, Oxfam, which is a charity in the UK, has published a report about the world's multi-million billionaires. And basically the conclusion they draw is that the 1% of the richest people on Earth have more wealth than the 99% of the population. But there's another fact in this report by Oxfam, which is that they saying that the amount of money by which the richest 2,000 people in the world have increased their wealth in 1 year, in year 2017, that amount of money alone, the increase in wealth that they have experienced, will be enough to solve the problem of extreme poverty in the world seven times over. So, I mean, that is so scandalous. It means that in reality, capitalism has created the economic means, the means of production, to solve the problems of the world's population many times over. The problem of poverty, the problem of destitution, the problem of lack of access to healthcare, the problem of lack of access to education and housing. There's no reason why these problems still exist at the beginning of the 21st century. The only reason is that the wealth of the world is concentrated in one end, while poverty grows at the other end. And the only conclusion that one can draw from this is that this wealth should be put, the wealth of the 1%, should be put at the service of the resolution of the problems of the majority. It's only democratic. I mean, these people, according also to the Oxfam report, these people do not actually produce any wealth. This Oxfam report says that 2/3 of the wealth of the world's billionaires comes from inheritance, from the monopoly position they occupy in the economy, and from tax evasion and the influence they have in governments. So in reality, they're not playing any useful role in production. They're not playing a productive role in society. They're just parasites living off the wealth that's created by working people. And I think this is what inspires us to struggle for a change, for a socialist society, which basically means a society where the wealth that is created by working people should be used and run democratically by working people themselves in the interest of the majority, not for the profit of a wealthy, unelected, unaccountable minority of parasites, who are the people who are now running the world and meeting in Davos to discuss how to continue running it.
Thank you so much for being with us today. How can people access your work?
It's been a pleasure, and I am part of the editorial board of the In Defense of Marxism website, which can be found at marxist.com. And as you said at the beginning, I'm also part of the Hands of Venezuela organization, Solidarity Movement, which can be found at handsofvenezuela.org.
Thank you so much for being with us.
It's been a pleasure.
Take care.
We've come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is an internationally syndicated weekly program made available through campus and community stations and available out to the world at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Visit Latin Waves Media to hear previous shows, to access resources, or support our efforts towards social change via community project engagement. Thank you and bye for now.